Welcome everybody to Between the Lines podcast from Jewish Quest, and this week we are exploring the Haggadah. We have spoken with Rav Edelman, and we also have Rabbi Zagoria Moffat, Rabbi Adam of St. Albans Masorti Synagogue in the United Kingdom, and it's wonderful, Rabbi Adam, to have you with us today. You gave a wonderful podcast a few months ago on Va'era, and you there spoke about the importance of the Egyptianness of Moses and the importance of Egyptianness being incorporated into Torah. And I wonder, really, maybe to start with, how you might incorporate that theme within Seder night.
Thank you for having me back, Simon. It's a pleasure. And I have to admit, I think the theme makes a lot of sense, but not incorporating Egyptianness per se, but incorporating Greekness, actually. Because to me, obviously, looking at the Seder and being somewhat a student of classics, although a pretty poor one, I'd admit, the fact that the Seder is not what it claims to be is one of the most interesting facts of it. The rabbis basically rewrote a huge part of Jewish ritual, which they didn't need to. All the other sacrifices that were performed in the temple, they needed to replace, and they had a mandate to do so. The Pesach sacrifice was done in people's homes. It didn't require the temple. We could have kept doing it after the temple was destroyed. The Tanaim could have just said, keep doing exactly what you've been doing with one lamb for each household, but they didn't. Instead, they constructed something entirely new, almost without precedent, and which we now have been doing every year since, which is partaking in a Greek philosophical symposium. And so I think if before, when looking at Exodus, we need to keep in mind the Egyptianness of Exodus, perhaps now in looking at Pesach, we need to keep in mind the Greekness of the Seder, because it is actually through and through a Greek philosophical symposium. Every detail of the Seder, including its vocabulary, including its setting, is meant to make us think of ourselves as philosophers. And that's quite a big divergence from what the Torah lays out as the rules of Pesach in Exodus chapter 12.
Fascinating. And I wonder how you see the difference between Greek symposia and the Seder.
There's practically none to some degree, right? If you consider what the symposium was meant to be, it was scholars sitting, mostly laying around, being served by other people, critically, and debating and drinking and discussing and singing, and by the end of the evening, tottering off home with some confusing songs in their mind. We do pretty much exactly that. But the subject matter of it is not a question of how to live the best life. It's not eudaimonia. It's what does it mean to be free, which is itself a philosophical question. So I think it's worth seeing the Seder as a symposium, Seder-posium, perhaps. And I think that actually, if we ignore the fact that the rabbis did something super-duper radical in creating this brand new, totally unrequired aspect of ritual, then we're missing a trick.
So just to maybe challenge one point, which is the Seder starts with let all who are hungry come and eat. And that democratic, truly democratic openness that the Seder has is surely different to the more elite symposia that would have taken place in the Greek, in a truly Greek setting.
I'm sure that's true.
Albeit otherwise plenty else to draw from. And maybe within Jewish tradition, we are all supposed to be philosophical.
I think that's it. I think it's somewhat disingenuous, actually, in the original context, the statement of let all who are hungry come and eat, because the setting of the Seder and the laws of Pesach that the rabbis put down in the Mishnah very clearly tell us that they intend for you to lay back and to be served. That's what it means to be free, is to be served by other people who are not. And there's a piece of the Seder which actually is about turning on its head who's served and who's serving. I learned a great deal about this from my first teacher in Pesach, my first teacher in basically Judaism altogether, a wonderful guy named Earl Schwartz, Hamline University in Minnesota, who had written this article called Served and Serving at the Seder, and completely, even while I was starting to think about Pesach, changed the way in which I thought about it. Because what does it mean to demonstrate freedom? Unfortunately, sometimes it means that the only way to demonstrate you're free is to exhibit how other people aren't. And as with the Greek symposium, the original Seder clearly implied that there was going to be people serving the food, preparing the food, serving the drinks, and people serving each other, which is perhaps the most democratic piece of it that we can cling to if we want to have that democratic piece, is the idea, which you still see at Sedarim, of people serving wine to each other, passing things along the table, sitting together in a somewhat non-hierarchical fashion. That piece is there. But as with the Greek philosophical schools, so too with the rabbis, their sense of freedom and openness and democracy was democracy for those who were willing and legitimate enough to have it. Right? Democracy in ancient Athens was not the democracy we think. It was restricted to few who within that group had a great deal of freedom. And there's a piece of that that's true as well for the rabbis. They say, let an all who are hungry come and eat, but perhaps they mean that more narrowly than we might like them to.
What are your particular favorite passages, and what will you be exploring by way of questions this year at your Seder?
I have many. It is hard to choose. I spent a lot of time with the Haggadah as part of my business doing some kind of Jewish publishing. I've worked to make several Haggadot. And it's given me a slightly different insight into what people gravitate towards in the Haggadah and why. At the end of the day, to be quite honest with you, my favorite part of the Seder every year is a Chad Miyodea, which is foolish and childish and silly, but at the root of it, it acknowledges the fact that although we have many high-level philosophical questions, what we really want the Seder to do is to create a sense of basic Jewish education, identity, and learning how to count is the most basic way to do that. And if people at my Seder walk away with nothing other than a better sense of how to count in Hebrew, then I think it's a success. So I think Echad Miyodea is a favorite because it's a lowest common denominator, because it makes slightly more semantic sense than Chad Gadyah, which I've never been able to figure out. And if anyone can, please let me know why we sing Chad Gadyah at the Seder. And I think that it's actually the basis of so much of the other stuff. Asking questions, answering them. We don't just ask to ask. We ask in order to be pedagogical, in order to find a way to teach and to expose people who are new to Jewish identity to an understanding of how they can embrace it in their own lives. And counting is the most basic part of that.
It's the only song, I think, in our Seder that we sing in both Hebrew and then in English.
For many people, I think that's true, because it's accessible.
Many of the songs and many of the themes start with history and end with speculation on the future. And even the structure is looking maybe backwards pre-meal and then looking forwards post-meal. What do you think the right balance to achieve between those two should be?
It's a great question. I think there's one of the Haggadot I did was very informed by kind of theater of the oppressed movement and Freire and the sense of actually acting out oppression as a way to process it and deal with it. And I think that the point of the Haggadah is that we're on the fulcrum between the past and the future, and that as a result, by experiencing the oppression that our ancestors felt and that perhaps we still feel today, and by in some way kind of inoculating ourselves against future oppression, isn't that what Shvoch HaMatcha is all about? We put ourselves in the position of being able to experience oppression in a way that perhaps we can heal from it. So I think the point is the present, really. It's not really about the past or the future to some degree, although we use the past and the future to counterbalance where we are right now, which is on this fulcrum point of our current lived experience. And that's why, especially in Sephardi communities, so much of the Haggadah is actually a theater play. We act it out. We get up, we dress up, we open the door, we smack each other with onions and leeks, whatever it might be. The foolish, the silly, the serious. Experiencing it is the point. And that means in the present, not just looking back and not just looking forward, but we need those in order to frame where we are right now.
Your involvement in the editing of many Haggadot, is that right?
Yeah. Have I had the privilege to help people make their own Haggadot, synagogues and individuals and families?
Wow, fascinating. And I wonder, with your experience of that, what you think makes the Haggadah the story that it is, really the story of all stories, that so many Jews who might not, between one Pesach and the next, experience Jewishness in any other way, but feel that sense of identity and belonging when it comes to Seder night and Pesach. What is it about the story that so grips the imagination?
I don't know that I have an answer. I've wondered the same myself many times, because I'm sure your listeners may know, but the Haggadah is the most published book in Jewish history, more than the Siddur, more than the Chumash. The Haggadah is the most rewritten, the most published. It was one of the first things that Jews did when they got printing presses, and they were really excited about the printing press, was run off the Haggadah. And yet it's completely unnecessary, because the Haggadah is the same every year. It's a grand total of, 20 pages at a push in the Hebrew. And yet every year, dozens of new Haggadot are created, each with a new theme, each with a new perspective, but the text remains the same. And I think that perhaps gives us some insight into its appeal, because the best stories are stories which are empty enough that someone can put into it whatever they'd like. The best stories in terms of comic books or fantasy or great stories that are retold, mythology, they're good because they are typological, because the same things happen and anyone can see themselves in that story, because it can be reread in every generation. And I think that's why the Haggadah is so effective. It keeps the details away from the story and focuses on the ideas of the story in a way that continues to be appealing and reappealing and able to be reinterpreted. The amount of different Haggadot that have given a certain spin to the story of Pesach just demonstrates really how flexible a story it is, even though it never changes.
It's such a contradiction in terms that we refer to the Seder, and yet it's such a hodgepodge as it comes together and continues to be embellished upon again and again.
Absolutely. And I think that's typical of Judaism, though, is we have a very good sense as a religion. And I think this is a credit to the rabbis, right? The Chazal, the Tanaim, that they understood the fact that they were faced with a Jewish people who were increasingly dispersed across different countries and cultures, who were no longer centralized in a place, in a particular climate, in a particular society, and who were politically and socially very diverse. And the best way they knew to keep everyone on the same page was to give everyone a story that allowed them to see themselves in it. Right? The famous rereading or alternate version of the Haggadah that Maimonides has, that it's not to see yourself, but to show yourself as being free, really is what the Seder is all about in some way. It is something that we can take and use for whatever purposes we need. And there's something deeply psychological about that that I think the rabbis understood. They understood that the Israelites, who now had so many different views and religions and cultures at their disposal and around them, needed something which contained their identity, but also permitted it to be recycled and reused and reinterpreted in innumerable ways. So it's really not a failure that it's a hodgepodge. It's not a bad sign. It's, I think, a real insight into the rabbinic sensibility of how to make something that lasts.
Maybe just finally, and this has been a wonderful exploration, if of all characters throughout Jewish history, or maybe all characters, who would you most like to share a Seder with?
It's one of those questions you get asked at interviews, isn't it? Who would you invite over for dinner if you had the opportunity to? As is probably quite evident, I'm a big fan of the rabbis, and their personalities and characters are really interesting to me. And there are a few people who I think would make for very good Seder guests. And I think one of the best is actually Yehuda Nasi, the man who in some way is responsible for everything we do today. And I have a lot of questions for him. One of the chief questions I have for him is quite related to the topic we started on, which is that there's this huge body of rabbinic legend that occurs in the Talmud and elsewhere, that he was best friends with the Roman emperor, Marcus Aurelius, supposedly, that they had tunnels built between their houses so they could have philosophical debates in the middle of the night. And I love that idea because it shows me that the rabbis are not who we think they were. They weren't necessarily isolated, narrow-minded, and culturally illiterate people. They were really richly developed in the societies in which they lived. After all, they made the Seder a symposium. And I'd be really curious to find out what someone like Yehuda HaNasi, friends with an emperor, responsible for the Mishnah, son of the patriarch, what was he like? I bet he'd be actually a really easy person to talk to and probably have some good insights on the Haggadah itself.
Rabbi Adams, thank you so much for sharing your insights and taking us through your whistle-stop tour of the Haggadah. We look forward to taking many of your questions with us on Friday night this week, and we look forward to welcoming you back again. And you shared the Egyptianness of in Vayera and the Greekness of the Haggadah. Look forward to seeing what we come up with next.
Me too. Thank you for having me again, and Chag Sameach.
If you like this podcast, please remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, do find out all about our exciting content that we have for you at our mothership, JewishQuest.org. We look forward to seeing you again next week, where we shall be exploring the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim.